You're listening to Write the Book, a podcast for writers and curious readers coming to you from Burlington, Vermont. I'm Shayla Shapiro. Today on Write the Book, you'll hear an interview with Vermont author Catherine Britton, whose first two novels, Her Sister's Shadow and Little Island, were published by Berkeley Books. We discuss her latest novel, Vanishing Time, which Catherine brought out this year. She has a master's degree in creative writing from Dartmouth College and a master's in education from the University of Vermont. Her screenplay, Goodbye, Don't Mean Gone, was a Moondance Film Festival winner and a finalist in the New England Women in Film and Television Contest. Here's a little information about Vanishing Time. Kama Truesdale's ex-husband and young son leave Boston for a boys-only fishing trip in South Carolina's Low Country. In the early morning hours, Kama is jolted awake by a phone call. There's been a fire on board the boat. Her ex-husband is dead. Her son is missing and presumed dead. As she sets off for South Carolina, Kama's belief that her son Tate is alive is unwavering, but her frantic search soon stirs up painful memories that send her reeling back to her childhood and the mysterious car crash that killed her Gullah mother and white father. As the clock ticks down, exhausted, haunted by dreams, and stymied by the police and local community, she enters a world in which she must rely on instinct over fact, where no one and nothing is what it seems, not even the boundary between the living and the dead. When I spoke with Catherine Britton, I began by asking her how Vanishing Time started for her.
Vanishing Time started for me back in about 2005, quite a while ago. I took a vacation to South Carolina and to the Grand Strand of South Carolina, which is the coastal, it's called the Low Country, coastal region of South Carolina. And I'd never been there before, and I was captivated by the landscape, the live oaks and the Spanish moss, and also the history. I went to they were the epicenter of the rice cultivation back in the day.
Mm-hmm.
World capital of rice production was in South Carolina. And, of course, it was all done with slave labor.
Mm-hmm.
And I simply hadn't been aware at all of that industry. And so I went to their rice museum. I thought, how could I resist going to a rice museum? And they presented sort of one side of it. They had these dioramas, which were sort of fun, and depicting life on these plantations. And these plantation owners, who were all white, were exceedingly wealthy.
Mm-hmm.
And then I also was very taken with the Gullah culture, which is there. The Gullah are descendants of enslaved Africans.
Mm-hmm.
Once slavery ended, they were given land on the coast, and then it was subsequently taken away from them. But they set up villages and lived there, and they continue to live there. And so these are just a whole different culture. You may have seen their sweet grass baskets, which is what they're probably most known for.
Yes.
And if you take a trip down there, you'll see them, and they're just beautiful.
Yes, and they sell them on the side of the road. We did. We were down in Charleston, and then we went for a long ride, and we did buy a sweet grass basket for a friend.
Yeah.
So that's the Gullah.
That's the Gullah. So I also then went to a place called Gullah Uman, O-O-M-A-N, which is in their language, woman. So it's Gullah woman.
Okay.
And it was a store and a sort of museum presenting the other side of the rice plantation culture, which was the story of how the seed actually came to South Carolina, which was from Africa on the slave ships brought to this country by the enslaved Africans, as was all of the cultivation techniques. And so it was just so interesting to me to see these two different sides of the story being presented. And there was a story quilt at this Gullah Uman store, which depicted the story of the crossing and so forth. And people are familiar with that whole sad time in our history.
Yeah.
So, and the other thing that happened while I was in South Carolina, they have a lot of ghost stories mm-hmm. for some reason in this area. They're just, I'm not sure why. Maybe it's the Spanish moss and the sort of climate that's there. But for some reason, there are many, many ghost stories that are told and presented through Chamber of Commerce publications and so forth. So I was sitting on the grounds of a former rice plantation, which is now a beautiful arboretum called Brook Green Gardens. And it's an arboretum and sculpture garden. It's a fabulous place. Mm-hmm. The live oaks that were on the property, of course, were original. They date back to when it was, in fact, a rice plantation. And I sat underneath them and I thought, there are ghosts here, and they're not the ones that I was reading stories about, but I just was struck by this notion of all the history that these mm-hmm. trees had witnessed, and decided to write a story about it. I was in a graduate program at the time. I wrote it as a screenplay.
Oh, wow.
And it was called, Every Goodbye Don't Mean Gone, which is a Gullah expression, and wrote it as my thesis for this graduate program at Dartmouth. And I submitted it to two screenwriting contests. I won one and was a finalist in a second one. So I had some confidence in this story, which I wanted to tell the story in some way about the plantation life. Having no history myself, I'm not Southern, I'm not Black, I have really no connection per se to that community. So I thought, what story could I tell that might somehow, where I might be able to tell their story?
Right.
And so settled on a person traveling to that area and experiencing some sort of stressful situation, such a traumatic situation, that they might conjure up these spirits or be susceptible to quote-unquote visitations from spirits, which I try very hard not to say that these are actual ghosts, that these are just a mind in deep distress.
I did like that you have a character named Nettie. I won't go too much into detail about who's who, but there is a character named Nettie, and she says, I can't remember if she says, houses aren't haunted, people are haunted, but it's along those lines. Places aren't haunted, people are haunted. And I thought that was a really good line. Was that something you read, that somebody had said that, or did you come up with that for that character?
I came up with that, and I love that line. Thank you.
It's a great line. No, it's a great line, and it so well represents what your main character is going through, which is that she's being haunted by some very harsh realities, some mysteries that she can't work out, and her son is missing or dead, and It is just a great line to help us understand why she is seeing supernatural figures or ghosts or whatever you want to call them.
Thank you. I feel affirmed because people have read it and sort of had, as readers do, you read a book, I do the same thing, and I bring to it my own worldview and what's going on in my life, and I read things, we all do, into fiction that might or might not be there,
right,
or that the author might or might not have it intended. So I wrote it as a screenplay, and then I turned it into a novel, and I sent it around to agents, and I did get my agent with this book, and then she couldn't sell it. So into the drawer it went. I wrote two other novels. They both got published, and then I decided to explore self-publishing or independent publishing.
Oh, interesting. And so this was really your first novel?
It was first manuscript, yeah.
Oh, I didn't realize that. Okay. Now, I want to talk about publishing, but before then, I just want to talk a little bit more about the setting. So you had been to South Carolina. While you were writing the book, did you go back there, or did you pretty much write from what your experience had been while you were there, from your notes, from your memories? I'm curious about that, because the setting is very beautiful and very well rendered, but it's clearly not one that you grew up in, so.
Correct. And I did go back. I went back twice. Not specifically to do research for the book, just so happened that we took a couple more vacations in that area. And so it's an amalgam, that setting, although I call it Polly's Island, and that is a real place. I've fictionalized everything else.
Okay.
So changed the names, and because I went to Charleston, I was down in the Edisto Beach area and the Pawleys Island area, so up and down sort of the Grand Strand.
Have you had reactions from South Carolina readers yet?
I have, well, one, a beta reader, someone who read an earlier version who had a history in Pawleys Island. So I did want someone who had lived there, and a couple of her, she thought it was great, thought it was lots of fun, and was able to tell me some stories about her childhood on Pawleys Island, and they made it into the book.
Oh, great. Okay. Now, I want to ask you another question, which, and this is also something you already brought up. Your main character, Kama, is the daughter of a Gullah woman from South Carolina and a white man. So I wanted to know how it was for you to write about race and how it affected the book and the actual storyline, your decision to include this aspect of her background.
Yeah, it was challenging, honestly, and that I had written a story with Kama simply being white and being from the Northeast and going down into this unfamiliar landscape with this very stressful situation. And my mentor in graduate school, who's an author, Ernest Hebert.
He's been on the show too.
read it, and he said, because Kama has this affinity for Mimi, who is my Gullah Uman, who runs the store, he thought to better explain Kama's affinity for her and interest would be to make Kama biracial. And so I did that. It changed the book dramatically. And so I did find myself going back. Of course, that gave Kama a whole different backstory, which then provided me an opportunity to do some a little bit of present-day race relations. It's not what the book's about. It turns out it's quite timely right now. And I did find it challenging, and there were times when I thought, who am I to write this?
That would be hard.
I certainly felt it in writing Vanishing Time. I felt very responsible to do this well.
Right. Yeah.
And I hope I've done that.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I think what's wonderful about Vanishing Time is that you have Kama's real-time experience, which is living in the now, and then you have a lot of storyline that crosses into the past and shows what it was like for the slaves that worked on this plantation, and it shows what's changed and how very much things have changed, and it does that very well, I think.
You're listening to Write the Book, a podcast for writers and curious readers, coming to you from Burlington, Vermont. Today's interview is with Catherine Britton about her new book, Vanishing Time. So I wanted to ask you about the suspense in the novel. There's a lot of suspense, and it was fun. You have, first of all, the storyline is frightening. A woman's son is missing. Her ex-husband has died while he takes her son on a fishing trip. And so she goes to South Carolina where they were on vacation, tries to figure out what's happened and where her son is and if he's still alive. So there's this incredible race against time to find her son. There are obstacles put in her path, but people create obstacles, but also just sort of the obstacles of not having any clue where to start. And then there are suspenseful aspects of the supernatural, which you already mentioned. So how was it for you? Have you written suspense since you first started with this book, or is this the only time you've really done that?
This is the only book that I always write these sort of cross-genre books that are exactly what you're not supposed to do, and from a marketing standpoint. But my Her Sister Shadow and Little Island are both family dramas. They're not nearly as much what I call this a psychological drama, which doesn't really fit any of the categories that Amazon and all those places want you to, the BSAC codes.
Right.
It has elements of a thriller. It's certainly not what one thinks of as a capital T thriller that doesn't have the global platform and, very little violence. But there is suspense. I do think there is some mystery in Her Sister Shadow and Little Island. but mm-hmm. it's a much quieter. It's more of a family secrets.
Yeah.
And
right.
so this is was my one and only foray into introducing suspense and an element of, you know, perhaps being called a thriller. And it's hard.
Yeah.
Actually.
Did you find it fun?
It was fun.
As an author, do you kind of get pulled into the suspense as well and find it kind of exciting and scary?
Well, it's more cerebral for me is what does my protagonist know and when does she know it? What does she think? What do I want the reader to know and mm-hmm. when do they know it? And how do you amp up the suspense? And there are two kinds of suspense. One is where the reader knows more than the character. And Little Island has that kind of suspense or drama. The reader is privy to far more information than anyone of that's a family reunion on an island in Maine.
Mm-hmm.
And it's in multiple points of view. And so the reader knows what everybody is thinking and doing, but the characters don't know what one another are thinking and doing. And that's a sort of suspense where the reader's thinking, when is this all going to fall apart? When are they going to discover? And then the other kind of suspense is the reader doesn't know what's really
right.
going on. And it's sort of the ticking time bomb under the table. It suddenly blows up. And,
right. And that happens with Vanishing Time, with this book, I think.
I hope so. There's certainly, yeah, I think the reader in this one maybe is tiptoeing along with Kama and being equally mystified as to, you know, what's going on, what things seem a little suspicious, but what is this all about? Why are people being so recalcitrant and not helping me? The frustration and certainly then it toward the end when the real thriller parts, the scary parts and the
right. Yeah. Well, and then there's this mystery in her backstory. Her parents died in a car accident. She was in the car and her memory is that a shooting star hit the car and that's why they died. And or a shooting star came toward the windshield and her father had to swerve to avoid it. And mm-hmm. that's also a wonderful little mystery where I was the whole time I'm like, well, what was that? Come on, that's not really a shooting star. And
good,
it was fun. Yeah.
That.
It was fun that also in the end did get explained and resolved and that
great.
Was another little moment. So I have another question about small characters. So you have some big characters that are really the stars of the narrative, Kama and another character, Sam. But then you also have some small characters here and there. And these are very small characters, but I loved this moment. And I wondered from the perspective of writing craft, if we could talk about the small details that fill in a character who might not have a large role, but whose presence in the book will inform the narrative and also to help us understand the other characters. So the example I'm thinking of is you have Uncle Reed and Aunt Jean. And early on, Kama, you write in the narrative, if she had believed in a divine being and thought it would do any good, she would have fallen on her knees and prayed. But Uncle Reed had always held that people who put on public displays of religion, which for him meant closing one's eyes in a group setting, lacked refinement. Prayer was for the helpless, the uneducated, the weak-willed, he had told her time and again, knowing nothing about the small, worn, leather-bound Bible that Aunt Jean kept tucked among the pillowcases in the linen closet. I loved so much about that.
Thank you. I love that little section.
I loved
too.
It. And actually, I kind of agree with Uncle Reed about putting on public displays of religion. Sometimes that can be a little irritating. Mm-hmm. I don't know that I think that prayer is only for helpless and uneducated people. But
right. But
then you give us Aunt Jean and her little leather Bible that she keeps secret. Just that small moment helps me understand so much about the people who raised Kama after her parents died. Do you have anything that you would say about how small details about smaller characters can add to a book?
Well, I think the first thing I would want to say about that, and I'm sure you have experienced this as well, writing is rewriting.
Mm-hmm.
So my process is I start with note-taking and reading books and visiting places and thinking, lots of noodling, many walks, and then filling notebooks with just notes and timelines and mind maps and so forth. And a story starts to present itself. And then the first thing I read on the computer, I call a data dump. And it's just disgorging all of this information that I have in a, hopefully the approximation of a plot-shaped narrative. Mm-hmm. And then I start editing, and it's both I'm both adding to and, you know, accretion and decretion. So,
right.
And the story changes so dramatically. And Uncle Reed and Aunt Jean have had so many different names. Her Tama's background has gone through so many different iterations, trying to figure out how much does a reader need to know about her time in Whitehead, and incidentally is where her sister Shadow is set, and mm-hmm. also one of the characters in Little Island lives there. So it's my one little conceit that I keep introducing Whitehead into different books. It's through the editing process, revision and editing process, that what do we really need a scene?
Right.
And I wrote plenty of them. And that really wasn't the story. That was just a distraction. And so I think one of the things I learned, writing suspense, you don't want extraneous. You have to just keep that plot moving and pare down.
Right.
Finding the most revealing dialogue or sentiment about a character that does reveal who they are.
Yes.
I believe in parsimony. So
yeah.
In as few words as possible, say as much as possible in as few words as possible.
Yeah, great. Okay. I wanted to talk a little bit about your publishing experience. You published this book yourself. Your other two books that came out before this, although they were written after this, you published more conventionally with found an agent and then that agent sold your books. So I wanted to know how your publishing experience was with Vanishing Time, and also a little tiny bit about what you do as an indie author to market your book and get the word out about it.
Decision to self-publish was that I had the manuscript. I did like the story. My agent liked the story. And increasingly, independent publishing or self-publishing is becoming more and more prevalent.
Mm-hmm.
A number of authors have simply decided to go that route. There are authors who are called hybrid authors who do both, and there seem to be benefits to each. I had a wonderful experience with Her Sister Shadow,
mm-hmm.
With my editor at Berkeley Books. I had the same editor for Little Island. The two or three years that separated those, I guess it was 2 years, those two books, even just 2 years, the publishing industry had changed dramatically from my perception.
Mm-hmm.
And my experience was different with Little Island, and mostly having to do with traditional publishers cutting their marketing budgets. So they do less and less for authors, and you end up doing more and more of the marketing yourself. And so I thought, well, I have this manuscript. I do like it. I'm curious about this independent publishing. I feel it's something I should know about because I do talks occasionally, and in my audience, half of the authors, the writers there, have decided they would like to self-publish. I teach at Osher, continuing ed at Dartmouth.
Mm-hmm.
Those folks want to know about it, so I thought, I need to go through it, and then I will know what the process is. And I wrote a blog post about being a digital immigrant, so I'm on the road to publication as a digital immigrant as opposed to a digital native.
Yeah.
Was very challenging because it is pretty much a digital world. And so I certainly accomplished my goal. I learned a lot. I know what a Mobi file and an EPUB file is. I know how to use Vellum. I have an account with CreateSpace and with KDP. I know what Ingram Spark, so I know all of this jargon that when I first went into it, and I did have a fellow author down here. Her name is Sarah Pinio. She is a romance writer, very successful romance writer who writes under a pseudonym.
Mm-hmm.
And she is a digital native, and it's second nature to her. And So she helped guide me, as did Sonia Hakala, who's also very good, very knowledgeable.
Okay.
So it was a steep learning curve with many hours of frustration, and I'm very proud of the final product.
Good.
In terms of marketing, while I thought, well, I'm doing so much marketing anyway, how different can it be? It is different. It is much harder to market a book without having a publisher who gets it out into catalogs that go to booksellers and having reps. And then they're not necessarily going to pick up your book and give a hard sell to booksellers, and I'm talking about bookstores here.
Right.
It's like being on a very small boat,
mm-hmm.
all by itself in a very large ocean, as opposed to, you know, a tender to a much larger boat, but you know that much larger boat is there, and certainly you can call on them for assistance and so forth. So I think self-publishing can work well if you write in a genre or if you write nonfiction,
mm-hmm.
and if you're doing a series, if you're really comfortable online, understand how to use Twitter and Instagram and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Well, love marketing. Short of that, if what you love to do is write books, it's enjoy writing the book, but don't expect it to
get. Don't expect to, yeah.
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 And it does happen, of course. Look at The Martian. I mean, it does happen.
Right.
The fellow who wrote that, yeah, he gave it away. He just published it either on Wattpad or on his website, and it got a huge following.
But, yeah. Now, yeah. You mentioned early in the before we started our recorded conversation, you mentioned early that you were working today on a Goodreads giveaway. So how does that work for you? You give away a certain number of books,
right.
And then have you had good luck with this in the past, where you do a giveaway and then it creates a little bit of spin around your book?
I did giveaways for both of my other books. I think that the publisher gave 30 copies of Her Sister's Shadow away, and I think there were 1,200 people who requested it. Little Island was only 5 books, and it was a smaller number. I decided to do 15 books, so
mm-hmm.
you just go on to Goodreads and register your book, and they tell you if you're good to go. And you tell them how long you want to run it. I did it for a month. I had over 1,000 people request it. So I am not good at return on investment. It doesn't cost anything to list a giveaway. What I now am in the process of doing, I did have to order my own books. I'm inscribing them. I'm putting them in envelopes. I'm going to take them. So there's a certain cost associated once you're getting the books in the mail. The hope is that these 15 people will write a review, and a good review.
Yeah.
You really don't know.
Right.
So, this is, again, if you understand how to track data and metadata and know, well, if I do this, I get this result, and this gets me this result, I'm basically flinging darts at a dartboard. I know what to do. I have a website, I have a Facebook page, I have a Twitter account. I love Pinterest, I have boards for my books, Goodreads, a blog, etc. And I don't honestly know which of those things is doing me any good at all.
Okay.
Huh. So you just keep trying different things. So 1,000 people maybe would remember the title of my book, but then again, I think there are possibly people on Goodreads who go through and just start clicking books and couldn't tell you what titles they had signed up for.
Oh.
So it's all a bit of a mystery.
Right.
I love doing guest blogs, and this podcast is fabulous, so I've done some guest blogs. I did giveaways there. I do either posting a guest blog or an interview. I get bloggers, try to get them to review the book. I started late. That other thing a publisher will do is give you a deadline, and they will meet it. I just kept moving my deadline back, and because I wasn't sure if I was ever going to get this book out. And consequently, I was very late in starting marketing.
Okay.
But, you know, it's all been about learning, and I'm still learning, and it's all good.
Do you think that you would want to go through this again, or do you think you're going to try to have your agent sell your next book?
I would love to have my agent sell my next book. Simply, I like writing.
Yeah.
And I loved partnering with my editor. I loved seeing what her edits were and thinking about them. And I did hire an editor, of course, for this book, and she was great. She saw things I hadn't seen, and I think she did a really, really good job. But I had hired her, and that's different from someone paying you, the author, money for the right to publish your book. They have a different investment, literally
right.
and figuratively, in your book. And so I'm hoping that, and the one that I'm working on right now is a young adult, so another little bit of a shift for me. Yeah.
Oh, I was going to ask you what you're working on now. Can you say anything else about it, or?
It's going to be set either in New Hampshire or Vermont. Again, I've fictionalized an area, and I just have to decide which side of the Connecticut River to put it on. And my protagonist is, I think, 17, which is sort of a typical age for young adult novels. It's a bit of a coming of age, I think, if I were to label it as anything. She's her father has had a stroke, and she's gone to live with her aunt, whom she did not know,
mm-hmm.
and she discovers things sort of more back in the vein of her shadow and Little Island, discovers some things about her mother that she didn't know. She's in a town, she's a stranger in a town where she doesn't know people, so she's meeting people and learning things about herself, some challenges rises.
That sounds good.
Yeah, thanks.
No, that sounds great. So where are you in the process of writing that? Is that brand new?
Some of it is brand new. I had written another manuscript, not as a young adult, about a woman of 39 in this case. It was her mother had the stroke. It had a whole other component that just didn't ever seem to quite hang together. So
mm-hmm.
some of the locations, at least, I'm very familiar with. And, of course, they look a lot like where I live, so I'm really familiar with them. But pretty much everything else, it turns out, is changing. But there are some similar relationships, but when you drop people down in age, relationships change quite a bit. And
mm-hmm.
how a 17-year-old thinks versus a 39-year-old, and what she's overcoming. And
right.
But it's been fun. I've done a lot of reading of young adults. And
They're fun.
I like a challenge. They are fun.
So, and then I guess my last question for you, Catherine, is what books might you recommend that you've read lately? Maybe a YA book would be one of those. I don't know, but.
the author, the young adult author I've been reading most, and I can't say that I've read one of her. I did read her. What I think is Sarah Dessen is her name. And I mm-hmm. may have read her most recent book. I'm not quite sure, but I've been going back. She's written quite a few and read, so none of them are new. But the book that I did read that I think is noteworthy is called Night Film by Marisha Pessel.
Oh,
yeah.
I read that one.
Did you? Yeah.
Yeah, that was.
What did you think?
That was very interesting. Very interesting,
yeah.
I thought. Yeah.
Yeah. Really plays with form, with structure and content, and yeah, she sort of left me a little breathless with
mm-hmm.
her ability with language and her characters. And so I was, from a writer standpoint, really impressed with that, with her writing and with her. I read one other of her books. And then for my book club, I'm reading one that the wonderful thing about reading groups is I read books that I would never even hear about. And
yes.
Obviously not read. And it's called Colorless, Tsukuri Tozaki's Years of Pilgrimage.
Ooh.
And it's a Japanese author. And so it's translated. And that is, I'm looking forward to our next meeting to hear what people think about it. Has a very different energy than books by authors from the United States. It's very interesting. And then I'm looking forward. Jacqueline Woodson has a new book coming out, another Brooklyn Ann Patchett has a book. She's one of my favorite authors.
Yes, she's
called
great.
Commonwealth. And Colson Whitehead has one called Underground Railway that I'm looking forward to. So,
oh, great. Yeah. That's a nice list. So, okay, well, I really enjoyed speaking with you. I want to mention the title of your book one more time. It's Vanishing Time, a novel by Catherine Britton. Thanks so much for speaking with me today. I really enjoyed reading your book and talking to you about it, and I hope it goes well for you.
Well, thanks so much. Yeah, it's been fun. It's a journey, and I'm enjoying it.
If you'd like to read more about Catherine Britton's work, you can visit her website at catherinebritton.com, and that's K-A-T-H-A-R-I-N-E. This week we have three Write the Book prompts, all generously suggested by my guest Catherine Britton, who is a writing teacher as well as an author. First, have a conversation with one of your characters. Ask him or her questions about motivation, goals, pet peeves. It's a good way to find a voice for a character that's different from the author's voice. Second, get two characters talking to one another off stage. Not a scene that occurs in the book, simply a chance for them to air their grievances or express opinions, things like that. It's slightly different from the author chatting with a character. And third, finally, write a scene from the perspective of an object in a location. What did that object see, hear, or experience? Such as in Catherine's book Vanishing Time, the live oak trees on the rice plantations. Good luck with your work in the coming week, and please listen next week for another prompt or suggestion. If you're interested in sharing this show with out-of-town friends, let them know that archived episodes of Write the Book are available on iTunes and at writethebook.podbean.com as free podcasts. You can visit Write the Book on Twitter and Write the Book Radio Show on Facebook for updates. You can also access the podcast at my own website, shelaughswithoutus.com. If you have a guest to suggest or comments about the show or news about book-related events, please send an email to writethebook@gmail.com. Tune in again next week to hear an interview with Vermont author Angela Palm, recipient of the 2014 Grey Wolf Press Nonfiction Prize, for her debut, Riverine, a memoir from anywhere but here, which Grey Wolf will release next week. I'm Shayla Shapiro, and you've been listening to Write the Book, coming to you from Burlington, Vermont.